This is a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.
Right, are you ready then? Is everyone on board? Have you strapped yourselves in? Because it's time to travel to some of the deepest and the most secret parts of the universe. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly, so keep your ears and your mind open and your arms inside the vehicle at all times, please. Yes, hello, welcome along. My name is Dan. This is the Fun Kids Science Weekly, the show every 7 days where we have a look at the most amazing, weird and wonderful things that are in science, really. Now, this week, we are pitting a human against a beast in a long jump challenge. Also in Dangerous Dan today, you can find out why something that's currently in the sea may have started its life in the stars. And in a sec, we'll chat to an expert all about the Great British Bee Count. Find out how you can help save a species. First, we're travelling back in time, way, way, way back to the age of the dinosaurs and meeting one of the most famously dangerous of them all.
Imagine going back in time, not 100 years or 1,000 years, but millions of years. To the age of the dinosaur. Welcome to the end of the Cretaceous period, around 65 million years ago. Around this time, there were more dinosaurs than ever before. The world was crowded with groups of Triceratops, duck-billed Edmontosaurus, squawking birds, and a wide variety of plant and sea life. The end of the Cretaceous period is also where you'd find one of the best-known dinosaurs of them all, Tyrannosaurus Rex.
He's coming this way! Quick, run!
You definitely want to run from a T-Rex. His name means King of the Tyrant Reptiles. And he was a terrifying meat-eating dinosaur found in the continent that is now North America. This carnivore was massive at over 12 meters long and 6 to 7 tons in weight. He gouged at prey with his enormous jaws and his curved teeth made it hard to escape. Despite standing as tall as an elephant, T-Rex's brain wasn't much bigger than a loaf of bread. However, a cast from a fossilized T-Rex skull shows the parts in charge of his sense of smell were bigger than in other reptiles.
Ugh, what's that horrible smell?
That's the smell of rotting meat. A T-Rex could sniff out a carcass from over a kilometer away. It might not have been as tasty as fresh meat, but it was an easy meal.
Quick, another T-Rex is coming.
That's not a T-Rex, but it's still good to hide. That's a Tabosaurus batar, or T. batar. Tabosaurus came from Asia, not North America, but had a lot in common with T-Rex. They looked similar and were both top predators. Scientists think they're closely related, even though they lived on the other sides of the world. Some have even suggested that they might be the same species, but there were differences. Lab tests show that Tabosaurus had a less flexible jaw, so he might have preferred carcasses to hunting wriggling prey. And whilst T-Rex had eyes that faced forward, Tabosaurus had more sideways facing eyes.
Oh no, I think he's looking at me.
I think he's more interested in that herd of hadrosaurs over there. When hunting, he'd prefer to pick off the old, young, or sick members of a herd. But let's not hang about.
Paleontology. Pick.
The age of the dinosaurs came to an end 65 million years ago. It is thought that a giant asteroid 6 miles across smashed into the Earth, where the town of Chicxulub in Mexico now sits, triggering tsunamis and dust clouds that blotted out the sun. Plants could not grow. Animals were cold and hungry and began to die. From the seas to the skies, many creatures and plants disappeared forever. In fact, 7 out of every 10 species perished. The age of the dinosaurs had gone, and with it 200 million years of the most amazing creatures the world has ever seen. Thanks to paleontologists, we know much about what it was like, but there are many mysteries that remain. Maybe one day, you will make a new discovery yourself.
You can listen to all of our Age of the Dinosaur series, catch up with them whenever you fancy, and travel back in time wherever you are for free right now. Download all the episodes wherever you get your podcasts from, you know, places like iTunes, where you may be listening to this show right now. Also, it's on the free Fun Kids app, and you can listen whenever you fancy at funkidslive.com. So this is a science question that's been sent in from Eva. She left us a 5-star review on the iTunes podcast store as well. So thanks, Eva. This is what she says. Why do sometimes we get bloodshot eyes when we use them too much? I've never really thought about it. It's a good question, though. Have you ever noticed this? Like, when you're concentrating really, really hard, you'll get, like, those red squiggly lines that run from the outside of your eyes all across the white right to the middle. Maybe, Eva, it's like when you've been running for ages and then your legs start to ache, or when you're writing and then your hand starts to hurt. I think it's that also probably got something to do with dehydration, you know, not having enough water in your body. I'll tell you what I'll do, though, for you, Eva. I'll try and get a science expert to come on the show really soon to talk all about your eyes, and we'll ask them. I could even ask my mum. She's a bit of an eye expert. I mean, she works in an optician's. But to be honest, I think that her expertise on eyes kind of runs out after she says, "Oh, those glasses look very nice on your nose." So no, Eva, we'll get a proper eye expert on for you. Remember, if you've got a question that you want answered from a proper science expert, you need to let me know first. The best way to do that is to leave it in the comments section of a review on the iTunes podcast store. So open that up, find the Fun Kids Science Weekly, drop us 5 stars, and I'll look out for your question. It's the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Now, the Great British Bee Count has started, and you are being asked to join the fight for nature by counting bees and by trying to save a species. And Rory Diamond is scientific advisor for the Great British Bee Count. He's a self-confessed bee geek, and he can help you save them. And he's in the studio. Rory, hello.
Hello, good afternoon.
Right, brilliant. Thank you so much for joining us. Here we go, first question. I'm always hearing that bees are like the most important part of wildlife, and they're really vital to how we live every day. Can you kind of tell us why?
Bees are incredibly important because they're pollinators, and that means you might have seen bees flitting between flowers, and as the bees go between the flowers, they fertilize them and help them to breed, and that produces all their seeds and fruits, and many of them are delicious ones that we eat.
And why are bees choosing the particular flowers that they are? Are there types of bees that only stick to some flowers, other bees that will stick to others, or is it a bit of a big buzzy free-for-all?
There are absolutely different bees that like different flowers, so it's actually over 270 species of bee in our country, and funnily enough, they have different length tongues for reaching into different shaped flowers, so some of them will go into really long, deep tube-shaped flowers like bluebells and honeysuckle, and some of them are after the nice open flowers like daisies.
Let's talk about the average day of a bee then. You mentioned that it's a really long tongue. I don't actually know how and why the bee does what it does. So could you just take us through a day in the life of a bee and tell me everything that it does that helps one flower pollinate?
So what bees are doing basically is they're gathering food for their babies. So young bees, a bit like young butterflies or caterpillars, young bees are grubs which live in the nest. And the mother bee is going to collect pollen for them from the flowers because that's really nutritious food for them. So she gathers the pollen either on hairs on her legs or hairs on her belly, depending on what kind of bee she is. And she's supping the nectar from the flowers as well because that gives us a big energy hit, a bit like drinking a fizzy drink. And as she goes between the different flowers, some of that pollen rubs off on the next flower, and that's what helps the flower to fertilise itself, and that's then how the flower can produce a fruit or a seed so that it can make new plants.
And do they have any idea the impact in a wider scale of the job that they're doing, or do they just think, oh, I'm going to go and get some food for my kid today?
Well, bees, yeah, they're just in it for themselves, really. They're just getting food for their kids and getting food for themselves, and in the process, they're really helping the plants along.
Wasps get a bad rap, I think, around the world, because they're pesky, they're annoying, whereas everyone sees bees as these really lovable, cute and cuddly almost creatures. Why is that? What's the difference, and why do you think that we prefer bees to the wasps?
So the funny thing is that bees are just vegetarian wasps. So I said that they're collecting pollen to feed to their babies. With wasps, they collect insects, or sometimes they collect meat. You might see them hanging around your barbecue. But wasps have a really bad rep, and people keep asking me, what's the point of them? But actually, there's lots of points to wasps. They're very good pollinators, like the bees are. And as they're hunting around for insects, they're also eating pest insects like caterpillars and aphids and things on gardeners' cabbages and roses. So they're very good for the ecosystem.
You're talking about cabbages there. We know that bees are really important to pollinate animals, to pollinate flowers, sorry.
Yes.
Things that we do and things that we eat every day. If we took bees out of the situation, if overnight bees went, how would that impact the food that's on our plate, the plants that we see in our garden?
Well, it would have a big impact. There are other pollinators, but bees are some of the best. They're the dominant pollinators. And they're pollinating things like fruits and lots of vegetables that we eat, and nuts and seeds. And they're actually, along with other pollinators, responsible for a third of all the food we eat in the world. And if we didn't have bees, there are some plants that can be pollinated by the wind, like cereal crops like wheat, which we make bread from, and rice. But I don't know about you, but I don't really fancy a diet of bread, rice and pasta every day. I really like my apples and my strawberries and my blueberries.
So what would be the first fruit that you reckon would go if the bees were to instantly die out overnight?
So apples are a big one that bees pollinate. The little red mason bee, which is one of our wild solitary bees, she's actually 120 times better than a honeybee at pollinating apples. And lots of spring bees come out around the same time that apple blossom is coming out, so that they benefit from each other. And there's lots and lots of other fruits that bees pollinate as well.
You say 120 times better than a honeybee at pollinating. What makes them so much better at doing
so,
that?
So solitary bees, they collect pollen in different ways. So honeybees have a very neat comb of hairs on their legs, which we call a pollen basket. And when they're packing the pollen on, because they've got lots and lots of babies to feed back at the nest, they use some nectar and some of their spit, actually, to pack it all together a bit like a lump of Play-Doh onto their legs. And that doesn't rub off so much onto the flower. But our mason bee, she has a really hairy pollen brush under her belly, and she collects the pollen all like powdery. It's like almost like the consistency of flour, if you felt pollen. And that means that as she goes between the flowers, that brushes off really easily on the other flowers and fertilises them a lot better.
Now, I keep bringing up this kind of nightmare situation that the bees might just leave our planet overnight. We wake up one morning, there are no bees anywhere. But it's not that far from the truth, really, is it? In that it's well known that bees are dying out. Why is that?
Yeah, unfortunately so. I mean, we've heard how important bees are to us, but we're not treating them all too well. So things like habitat loss, they've lost most of the wildflower meadows in our country since the Second World War, and that's due to changes in how we farm and how we manage our landscapes, and that means there's a lot less food and shelter for bees. But also things like the pesticides we use to kill pesky insects on our crops, they can make bees very ill too, and they can stop bees from breeding and making other bees. Climate change as well is another factor that might be affecting them. So there's all kinds of pressures that bees are facing every day.
Now, you're here with the Great British Bee Count, which is trying to help us save the species. There are things that we can do every single day. There are things that we can make in our garden to help bees out. Now, here's the thing. If you want to find out what you can do, if you want to find out how you can build a bee hotel, you'll need to be here. So make sure you're back then with more from Rory Diamond. It is time for this week's Dangerous Dan, where we take a look at some of the most deadly things in the universe. Now, normally, round about now, we talk about like an animal, or a chemical, or a place, or a disease, but today, it's all about a possibility. Now, listen up. There's quite a backstory to this, but the ending is brilliant. You'll want to hear it, I promise you. Now, octopuses, they have stumped scientists for centuries because the experts think that they suddenly appeared in the ocean out of nowhere about 270 million years ago. And they've also had a look at the genetics of an octopus, and it's really smart. It's got a level of complexity that's hardly seen anywhere else on Earth. They don't think that they could have evolved from anything either. They say the DNA and the genetic code of an octopus is almost alien. And get this, long before the emergence of them, millions of meteorites and cosmic satellites were crashing into the Earth, and scientists think the octopus came with it. There is a theory that octopuses are really aliens, and that some of the eggs were frozen inside a meteor, and when that crashed into the ocean, the eggs hatched, and now we've got a sea full of squids. Now, I know it sounds a bit crazy, but just think about octopuses for a second. They've got eight legs, they're freeform, they're squidgy, they've got huge eyes, massive heads, they can shapeshift to fit through tiny holes. They do look a bit extraterrestrial, don't they? If it makes sense, and if it is true, and octopuses really are aliens, then this is truly dangerous. It is the Fun Kids Science Weekly. I got a nice, heartwarming story all about this country's oldest turtle to tell you about in just a sec. First, let's catch up with our alien friends, NNG. Their spaceship is broken down on Earth. They've got no power to try and get it home, so they're travelling around the world looking at all the different energy sources that could help them get back home. And today, they're talking about gas.
NNG's Energy Challenge.
G, what are you doing, apart from making a terrific mess in this Earthling's house?
I'm trying to find the gas. I know it powers the heating and the cooker. They must have a whole load of it somewhere. Maybe in a cupboard. Nope, not there.
G, gas isn't kept in the house. It's, well, a gas for starters. It would just float away. It's also extremely flammable. That means it needs to be kept very safely in pipes or canisters. Otherwise, it might just... Yeah, that.
But where does it come from? I don't understand.
Well, to find out where it comes from, we'll have to start a long way from here.
It's chilly out here, so I can see lots of big drills and pumps. I'm guessing that they're mining for gas?
That's right. Gas comes from deep under the earth. It's found in layers of rock with tiny holes, which holds the gas like a sponge. To bring it to the surface, gas companies drill down hundreds of feet and pump out the gas.
Can't they just teleport the gas out?
Earthlings can't teleport anything anywhere, G. They have to do things the hard way.
And it certainly looks very hard, all that rock to get through. Just another reason I am not a fan of this planet, N. Although gas is a handy energy to have.
Humans won't have gas forever, though, G. There's about enough left underground to last 100 years. Maybe 200, if they're really careful and don't waste it.
I'm guessing we're not going to be able to take some to help us get home, then. That would make it run out even more quickly. So how does it get from under the ground into home?
So, gas companies drill down thousands of feet into the earth and use big wells and pumps to capture it. Brace yourself, we're going to find out how it's carried around the country. Deep underground, there are hundreds of miles of high-pressure pipes like this one. They carry gas to where it's needed.
It's certainly a squash and a squeeze in here, Anne. Couldn't you just have, you know, shown me on a computer?
Well, you asked. If you think this is bad, and this is a gas mains, wait till you get nearer to the homes. The pipes get a lot smaller.
I thought we were going back into the house.
We're inside the meter. It measures how much gas is being taken from the pipes so that the customer pays for just the right amount.
It's good to be out of the pipe and back in the warmth. Put the kettle on, I'm parched.
Put the kettle on? You sound like a proper earthling now.
It's exhausting being a gas, travelling all those miles.
It's a big job to look after those pipelines, as gas can cause explosions when it catches fire. It's important to keep the gas safe. The gas companies take care to fix and repair the pipes and improve things to keep things running smoothly.
Right, so that's why you see roads and pavements being dug up sometimes. And I thought they just like digging. Ha!
Watch out! Looks like we're gonna fuse, G! Here it comes!
Whoopee!
I love a bit of fusion! Here it comes! Woohoo!
NNG's Energy Challenge with support from National Grid. Find out more online at funkidslive.com/energy.
Let's talk about all the science that has been in the news this week then. Scientists have discovered the most distant sign of oxygen ever. They observed the gas in a galaxy of stars that existed just 500 million years after the Big Bang, just. But they figured out, though, that it looks like it's even older than that. And it was made when an even older group of stars died. So they think this oxygen could be from just 250 million years before the Big Bang. Also, Madagascar has emerged as a whale shark hotspot after a large number of the endangered species were seen off the coast. 85 individual whale sharks were spotted in a single season there. They were noticed because of their distinctive stripy and spotted markings. Now, it's not too much of a surprise because there are many incredible animals around Madagascar, and scientists think they don't live there, they just travel to the island off the coast of Africa for food. And finally, sticking to the sea, the UK's oldest sea turtle has returned to its former home. Lulu the turtle spent the last 15 years in captivity in Brighton. She is 80 years old, she weighs 28 stones, and she's gone back to the Sea Life Centre in Blackpool to chill out while she has a bit of retirement. Right, we've got more science in the news at the same time next week. Right now, I've got a creature challenge.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
You join us just as the competition is about to begin. We're pitting man against animal once again in our Extreme Athlete Challenge. So who can scale the heights to be the highest jumper on the planet? First to compete is Javier Sotomayor from Cuba, who set the world high jump record in 1993. And waiting his turn is the kangaroo rat, although I'm assured he's actually a rodent, not a marsupial.
He's about the size of a small cat and normally lives in sandy hot places like Arizona and Mexico and uses his quick reflexes to escape from predators.
Sotomayor to jump first. He's taking a run up. And what an amazing jump. He's cleared 8 feet.
That's over a foot taller than he is himself. What an achievement.
Now it's the turn of the kangaroo rat.
Astonishing. He's equaled Javier's 8 foot height and he's no more than a foot tall. That has to be an even more amazing achievement.
To have equaled this achievement, Javier would have had to have leapt over 160 metres in the air.
And I don't think even he would like to try that.
So let's hear it for the kangaroo rat, one of our extreme athletes.
Extreme Athlete Challenge with the Society of Biology.
Loads more Extreme Athlete Challenges that you can catch up on for free on your phone or tablet. Just get them wherever you get your podcasts from, you know, places like iTunes, all of that. Also, they're on the free Fun Kids app, which will keep you busy whenever you're bored, I promise. And you can always have a listen at funkidslive.com. So that is it then for another episode of the Fun Kids Science Weekly. Thank you so much for coming along on this mysterious and dangerous journey to the deepest and darkest parts of the universe. I'll see you again next week. Now, in the meantime, remember, if you've got a science question, something that's niggling away at your brain, maybe it's something your teacher told you in the classroom that you thought, what? How can that possibly be true? Or maybe your mate told you something in the playground and you thought, hang on, there's no way that is true. Well, I can settle the argument for you. You need to let me know first. To do that, you drop it in the comment box of an iTunes podcast store review. So find the Fun Kids Science Weekly on there, leave us that review, write in your name as well so I know who you are, and then I will see your question. While you're on there, you can also catch up with all the brilliant Fun Kids Science series, and you can get them on the free Fun Kids app and over at funkidslive.com, and you can listen to Fun Kids all around the country on your DAB digital radio on that free Fun Kids app and over at funkidslive.com.
So that was a podcast from the children's radio station Fun Kids. Listen on DAB digital radio across the UK or online at funkidslive.com.